We're going to head over and speak to Mark Morris on his book, The Anglo-Saxons, The History of the Beginnings of England. How are you, Mark?
Okay, sorry about that. Let's go back. We're going back 1,600 years ago, Mark, here. Very long time in our history.
Yeah, so as I was saying, we start at the end of Roman Britain and carry the story forward all the way to the beginning of the Norman Conquest, 1066. Yeah. So 6.5 centuries. And one of the points I make at the beginning of the book is that means it's difficult to make generalisations. People often talk about the Anglo-Saxons and talk about Anglo-Saxon warfare or Anglo-Saxon manuscripts, which is not particularly meaningful. It's as meaningful as talking about, you know, warfare between the 14th and the 19th century. So this is a sort of straightforward narrative history taking you through from a very, very sophisticated society in Roman Britain.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to 1066 again, a very different type of society has emerged. One of the things that I'm not someone who does Roman history. I've always done medieval history. And when you look at Roman Britain, to me, as someone who hasn't studied it in any great depth, it feels very alien because you're talking about it's a province or it's a diocese and it's divided into provinces and there are priests and there are cities and there are... It doesn't feel familiar. Whereas by the time you get to 1066, you're in a world of shires and bishops and boroughs and earls and all of these things which still exist in the England of today. So it's a sort of an exploration of, it told us a story as to where did these institutions, where did these phenomena come from?
And like you say, you talk about the end of the Roman period, and it would have been the kind of the Roman culture, sophisticated villas, great buildings. What became of what was the legacy of Rome at that time? Or was it kind of just, you know, left and discarded?
Well, as far as I can determine, most of it is kind of broken beyond repair in the 5th century.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens is, it was one of the things that struck me, as I say, because I cut my teeth doing medieval history at university, and I'd never studied Rome in any depth. And, of course, Rome is only the sort of entry point into this story. It's just the dawn days of Roman Britain. And one of the things that struck me was the collapse of sophistication. So when you're talking about Roman Britain, as you say, you have towns and cities and they have tens of thousands of people living in them, and you have a very high degree of specialization. So if I were living in third or fourth century Roman Britain, I could have been a potter or a mosaic layer or someone who was a notary or a soldier. You know, there's a vast array of different jobs. Once that system collapses and you have kind of a total systems collapse in the early 5th century and you don't even have things like coins anymore, so you have all of a sudden you've got just a barter economy and you don't have things like nails because you lack to make nails. So these very, very fundamental things that keep society ticking over are gone.
Yeah.
And what you get instead is a society which is more like sort of modern survivalists. So you have to be able to make your own clothes, rear your own pigs, slaughter your own pigs, you know, make your own food, build your own house from scratch. So it's a great drop in terms of sophistication.
Yeah. That went right across Europe, of course, but with the Roman Empire falling. But when it comes to England in particular, who are these people that turn up, these Anglo-Saxons? Where are they from and what do they bring to the table?
Well, Bede says, the famous historian of the early 8th century, who is the fullest source. One of the problems, I should say, to begin with, is when the society collapses, we lack written sources.
Yeah.
So we have archaeology, which can tell us a certain amount, but doesn't tell us all we need to know. Bede says that there are three peoples who come from Germany. So Germania in Rome, beyond the Roman Empire, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. Now, Bede is oversimplifying. We know that they were coming from all around the northern coast of Europe and the southern coast of Scandinavia. So there were Frisians, there were Franks, there were Swedes, as well as Jutes, Angles, and Saxons, all coming together, or rather all sort of emigrating into what was Roman Britain. The thing that always has kind of flummoxed people is the scale of this immigration.
Yeah.
And traditionally, and in the narratives that were told at the time in the Anglo-Saxon period, this was a sort of total replacement of one population by the other, which of course cannot have been the case.
No, I was going to ask you what happened to the people who were, you know, like the non-Roman slaves at the time and those
that
are already there.
What happens to the population in situ? One of the things that happens to the population in situ because of the collapse of the Roman system is a lot of them perish because of the collapse of agriculture and the pastoral economy, which isn't able to feed enough. So I am still imagine a 5th century, which is fairly catastrophic in terms of the population dropping by as much as half. But even if you take the lowest estimates for late Roman Britain with the population, you cannot have anything like the number of newcomers from Northern Europe who would have replaced the population. So the newcomers are still a minority, which begs the question, why does their culture triumph? And I think it's simply because, as I say, they're better at coping in the adverse circumstances of the 5th century in a way that, say, I would not cope very well if society collapsed tomorrow.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who could build their own house and rear their own pigs and very importantly, defend themselves. If you lived in late Roman Britain, the army defended you and you were not allowed to bear arms as a civilian.
Yeah,
which is why they were employing barbarians from beyond the empire to fight for them. But the problem is when the barbarians get fed up and turn their swords on you, their hosts, then you're in difficulty, which is what Bede tells us happened. So, as I say, it's difficult to know the numbers, but what is clear is that the peoples who are coming from Germany and southern Scandinavia, it's their way of life that wins out because we start talking, we have days of the week which are based on Germanic gods, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, etc. So they're pagan for the first couple of centuries. And also their language wins out. We don't speak Brittonic anymore. Welsh, Cornish, Cumbria, they speak Brittonic languages, but Germanic language, Old English, is what ultimately wins out in the lowlands of Britain, in eastern and southern Britain. So they are the people calling the tune from the 5th century onwards.
And it must be difficult to write a book because you're talking about 600 years, I think, aren't you? Literally centuries of history. So it's difficult to, if you think of what UK was like, written was like 600 years ago from now, you think the difference. But there are, in the midst of all of that, some great characters like King Offa, Alfred the Great, and Edward the Confessor. Those are some of the names that we'd recognise, but there's also some other great characters there as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's curious, you might expect that the evidence just steadily improves the closer you move towards the present, but it goes in fits and starts.
Yes.
So I've already mentioned the Venerable Bede, writing in the early 8th century. He is fantastic. He's like 500 pages of modern print, and he's looking back on the century before him, but he tells a tale which is crammed with ambitious bishops and, you know, warrior kings. And so that the 7th century is very brightly illuminated because of one very prolific author. Then you move forward into the 8th century, which you mentioned King Offa. King Offa builds the longest linear earthwork in Europe, Offa's Dyke, 150 miles, 80 miles of which survive. You know, so it's got this colossal building enterprise about which we know nothing because there are no narrative sources. So you have to, in that case, approach it sideways and look at things like more prosaic things like charters and coins and papal letters. So it becomes a sort of detective story. But it was a fun book to write because there were bits of it that I knew because I'd been, I know, it's not my first rodeo, Dave. I've been doing it for 25 years. But, I'd done King Alfred. I'd done Ethelred the Unready. I'd done Offa to some extent. But the bits in between, between those more famous friends, I had great fun writing a chapter on Bishop Wilfrid.
Tell us more about Bishop Wilfrid, then. We don't give too much away. No spoilers.
Well, I mean, I'm again, cards on the table. I've always tended towards secular politics when I've done my history because ecclesiastical history can, for some people, be a bit of a turnoff, can be a bit of a yawn, because you imagine bishops were sort of more into sort of like saintly acts, you know, being kind to children and animals, watering potted plants, that kind of thing. And when you look at the life of Wilfrid, he's falling out with the king, being thrown into prison, being sent into exile, going into pagan lands, fighting with bands of pagans, sponsoring coups in foreign countries, going to complain to the Pope. So you read this source material and you think, this guy deserves a chapter in himself. He lives to be 75, for heaven's sake. So he has this tumultuous tale that takes you everywhere you need to go in sort of 7th century Britain, as telling the bigger story of how it goes from a pagan society to a fully Christian one. So as an author, you when you stumble across source material like that, you think, well, this is a gift. You know, obviously, this is going to shape the narrative. So there was another guy that I won't go into any more detail, but similarly in the 10th century, the 10th century kings of England are hugely important, but they're just names on a page. I mean, you can rattle them off. Yeah. People like Edmund, Edred, Edwy, Edgar. We don't know anything about their lives at all, but the bishops and archbishops who are serving them, like St. Dunstan, St. Athelwold, St. Oswald, they have very rich biographies, and they live to be old, old men, and they are clearly forming government policy. So again, that was a chapter structured around St. Dunstan.
Yeah.
And that was an enormously fun chapter to write, simply because it felt like a story that hadn't been told in quite that way before.
And that's what I like about it, is because, you know, we do have our historical greatest hits, don't we? And, you know, King Henry VIII, of course, and, you know, Queen Elizabeth I, and you know, the War of the Roses, and you know, I love all that. I love medieval history. But this, to me, really is far more uncharted, and there's so much great stuff going on, even in those times, and really shapes the way we are today. What would you say, I'm not sure how much you cover of that in the book, but what would you say is the legacy of that era?
Oh, gosh.
That'll put you on the spot.
Well, I cover it in the conclusion. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the sort of, to a risk of sounding trite, if you're in England, it's the country around you. It's understanding the country you live in.
Yes.
It's wondering why, you know, if London is the most populous place in Roman Britain and in the late Anglo-Saxon period, why is the English church based at Canterbury? And that's just the coincidence of the fact that the King of Kent was the person on the ground who received St. Augustine from Rome, and he very much thought that the church should be based in his capital city in Canterbury. Why is the political centre of gravity in the UK at Westminster? It's just due to the fact that the Confessor rebuilt Westminster Abbey and built himself a royal palace next to it in the 1040s, 1050s. So it's, you know, why do we have shires? Why are the bishoprics in these places? And it's that understanding of, you know, as I said, history is intrinsically fascinating, but it's just nice to know the origins of things. That's why I put the word beginnings in the title.
Yes.
You want to know how the story starts.
Why do you say the beginnings of England and use that term England for this particular time period? You know, we talk about Roman England, and why do you...
Well, we talk about Roman Britain.
Yes.
I mean, because England is a word that is coined in this period. So, of course, when you start in this period, you talked briefly about the arrival of waves and waves of Germanic immigrants. They form a galaxy of competing kingdoms in the 6th, 7th centuries. So not just the seven that people are perhaps familiar with, like East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, Sussex, etc. They are the larger survivors of a bun fight that begins in the 6th century, which had dozens of kingdoms in it.
Yes.
But the question that I suppose one of the sort of leitmotifs of the story is, how do you get from this galaxy of competing kingdoms to a single kingdom of England, which is, of course, an epic saga involving Vikings and Alfred the Great and Athelstan, etc. But by the time you get to the end of the 10th century, there is one kingdom with one king and one coinage, etc. And people by the end of the 10th century are calling this new polity Englalanda.
Ah.
So it is the word England itself is a coinage at the end of this period. So people often think of, you know, English history begins in 1066. It doesn't. The Kingdom of England coheres in the 10th century.
So maybe I need to let people off when I hear people say England.
I think, you know, there's a term that's due a comeback.
Yeah. Well, and I'm always getting mixed up with my UK, British and English history and when to say the right term there. But anyway, I can feel your passion for this, Mark. I really can. And it's so evident there in your voice. But it's a great book. It's The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England, Mark Morris. It's available on our website, tre.radio. And it's fascinating. I never used to be into history at school, Mark, at all, you know. But since leaving school, I've been watching documentaries. It's something I really, and I love visiting historical sites around Spain. So Yes. Some...
I don't think you should beat yourself up about that, because every single person I meet says that to me. And I think the simple truth is, when you're 10 years old, you're focused on the present.
Yeah.
You know, what's on TV, what's for dinner. You have no sense, or very little sense, of the passage of time.
I do think teachers are better now, though. Maybe just bringing it to life a little bit.
No, I don't. I think teachers were, you know, trying their best to... I've been a teacher for a brief stint in my life, and I know getting children interested in anything other than their phone or their computer or, you know, Blackadder or whatever it was in my day. Whereas as you get older, you start to think, it's not that there was something before me. It's not just all about me. There's a story that starts way before I do, and people become fascinated as they go. It's one of the benefits of getting older is your widening curiosity.
I'm starting to realise that. Thank you, Mark. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it today. Stay safe there.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Lovely.
Bye.
Thank you, Mark.